This is the Medicast, March 17th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 109. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's show. If you're a brand new subscriber to the Medicast, welcome to the Medicast, and I urge you to head over and check out all of the information available over at medicast.com. That's the main page for the Medicast network. You'll find links there that'll take you to the Medicast blog and show notes links for this particular episode and all of the other past Medicast episodes. There are also links on that page for the Nursing Show podcast, the Medicast News podcast, all of the other affiliated shows with the Medicast network, as well as links to the Medicast store. And there'll be more information coming up on some new and exciting things happening with the Medicast later on in this episode. Of course, if you're a long-term subscriber, thanks for all of your input, your comments, all of your suggestions, even your corrections. When I make a mistake, I want you guys to let me know so that I can share that information back with the community. I really enjoy the community effort here, and I want to thank all of the long-term listeners for contributing their efforts to making the Medicast one of the best EMS podcasts out there. This past week, we hosted the Medicast Live here at the Medicast Network, and we had a great episode on Tuesday night with listeners calling in, checking in via the chat room, and listening live. And we had special guest Kim McKenna sharing her viewpoint on what it takes to be a good EMS student, as well as our regular panelists Rick Rosati and John Bignell. We really had a good discussion, helped share a lot of tips and information on what we think it takes to be a good EMS student. If you haven't checked out that episode, you can go over to medicastlive.com and check it out directly there at its main page at the TalkShoe Network. Or you can come over here and make sure you subscribe via iTunes or your other favorite subscription service for podcasts, and you can actually get that episode downloaded as part of that subscription. All of that's available. Plus, as we do every month on the Medicast Live, we had a winner of the Medicast t-shirt. That's going to be listener David. Just for listening live that night, he gets a special promo code. He can send that via email, and he did so. And he was selected among all of those that sent in emails. There's not that many people that follow up on this particular opportunity, so I urge you to check out next month's episode of the Medicast Live, and you can find more information for that over at the website. So, David, I've sent you an email. Check your email if you were part of that process, and you need to send me back your contact information and shipping address so I can get that off to you. There has been some great discussions over in the Medicast forums. Head over to forums.medicast.com and check out all of the discussions that are occurring over there. I know somebody sent me an email and wanted to know where I'd been. I haven't been showing up in the forums lately. I have been very busy working on a great project and addition here to the Medicast. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But I wanted to let you all know that I do check in. I get emails every time a new discussion started over there. So I actually have been following via that email service, but I have not been there directly. I plan on working on that this week, getting over there and contributing to the discussions. But the beautiful thing about the forums is you all can contribute to the discussions yourselves. And this is a way for, first of all, not to always hear my opinion on everything, but also to share with each other your own tips and tricks. We all have a lot of valuable information to impart, and the Medicast forums is a great way to do that. Free to sign up and register over there. If you're not a member, I urge you to head over and check it out for yourself at forums.medicast.com. I got an email in from listener Glenn, all the way from New Zealand. First of all, Glenn, thanks for checking out the show. I'm always amazed at how many international listeners that the Medicast has picked up, especially, interestingly enough, in both Australia and New Zealand. I know I have a lot of listeners in Canada, but Australia and New Zealand figure very highly, as well as people from the UK and other parts all over the world. I just want to thank you very much for sharing. And I wanted to check in because listener Glenn was asking about something about the HALO test and that there's no evidence that the HALO test actually works to indicate cerebral spinal fluid or the presence thereof. You know, I'll have to check on that, Glenn, and maybe I can get back to you in a future episode. Does anybody else have any information on this? Send it in to me here at podmedic@mac.com, and maybe you can do some of that research for me and shoot me some links on whether the HALO test is backed by any science or if it's just something we've done and may or may not be as effective as we expect. Speaking of international listeners, I got a response from listener Amit over at our Facebook page for the MedicCast. If you are on Facebook, you can catch up with me over there. Just search for PodMedic at Mac.com or the PodMedic over at Facebook. And please feel free to get me added as a friend. I'll be happy to respond to you over there. Listener Amit just wanted to check in and say that he wanted to thank me for the podcast. And he is a combat paramedic with the Israeli Defense Forces and in Israel. So another listener from a faraway place checking out the show. Amit, thanks for checking in. And please feel free to share any information you'd like to about some of the unique procedures and things that you've learned in the course of your work there. I also want to say hi to listener Jay out in Washington. He's a paramedic instructor. And Jay, you sent me a voicemail. I got it, but got it a little too late to get back in touch with you directly to invite you to contribute to the show. And I apologize for that. I would encourage you to get back in touch with me, and I'm going to try to shoot you an email as well. But I'd love to have you participate in any future episodes that you'd like to as far as the MedicCast Live. And you can always send me information also by email at podmedic@mac.com. And please feel free to share any pointers or tips or anything else for the other listeners. We'd be happy to share them and even put them up on the blog if they're in text form. So I want to let you know I did get your message and apologize for not getting back to you more quickly, but sometimes it's easier for me to respond to you here, and I'll try to get back to you as well via your email address. Speaking of voicemail, I got a voicemail from listener Tim, who was responding to help out a prior listener who had written in about getting his EMTB as a military member and how he went about doing so while he was still in the military. And you guys are great. You always seem to find the information and help out. And listener Tim sent in his information.
Hi, Jamie. This is listener Tim. I was listening to your last podcast with listener Harris, who was in the Navy looking for EMT training. As a retired military member myself, one of his options would be go to his education center and or check with his medical command. The military used to use EMT Basic as the cornerstone for their medical training. Not sure what the Navy's plans are. It has been 10 years since I was on active duty and retired. Glad to help out, and you can reply back to me if you need by email. I'll give that to you in just a second.
Tim, thank you very much for that. And of course, I trim off the emails when you leave them at the end, so you don't have to worry about that going out. But Tim, I want to thank you again for sharing that information. And Harris, if that is something that works for you, if you are able to follow up and get that information, let me know if it worked, because that way we can share this back with the other listeners. There are a lot of listeners in the military that keep up with the MedicCast, and we'd like to provide them the resources they need to further their EMS training as well. If you'd like to share a voicemail comment, you can call in anytime you want to the voicemail line here at the MedicCast at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. And Tim, thanks again for your comment. Time to move on into this week's news, and I will start off with a story that's just a cautionary tale for all of us. This is out of Iowa, and it has to do with an ambulance and the driver of that ambulance that was involved in a fatal motor vehicle accident. The accident occurred when the ambulance was involved in a motor vehicle accident, struck a sport utility vehicle, and killed the driver of that vehicle sometime in mid-February. And at this time, the driver of that ambulance has been ticketed as being at fault in the crash. And this is with violating state law, and that allows emergency vehicles to proceed past a red or stop signal or stop sign, but only after slowing down as may be necessary for safe operation. And what this is going to mean is that they're going to be charged with this, and if they're found guilty, it would contribute to any kind of lawsuit involved with the accident that occurred. And, you know, I talk about this all the time, folks, but, you know, there's been many, many studies done that says that those extra few seconds just aren't significant when transporting a patient in an emergency status, that you can't slow down or come to a complete stop when there's a red light signal or a stop sign. And I'll tell you what, I slow down even when I have the green light at intersections. I don't assume that oncoming traffic from other directions is paying attention. My understanding of emergency vehicle operator safety standards should be that all drivers use what I was taught as due regard. And that is that you can operate as an emergency vehicle and travel outside of the posted speed limit and disobey some traffic laws, but you must always do so with due regard to the safety and safe operation of the vehicle. And that includes stopping at stop signs, stopping at red lights. People don't hear very well in their cars. Cars are sealed up tight as a drum so they can provide a quiet driving experience. What's a quiet driving experience mean? Quiet driving experience means that you can't hear an ambulance when they're right behind you with their siren blaring, their air horns going, and their lights blazing away, and you don't even know they're back there. We've all seen it. Is that an excuse to tailgate the person? No. Is that an excuse to run through intersections without paying attention to oncoming traffic? No. And so I would urge all of you that this is a completely preventable situation. If you're driving your unit, you should be slowing down and or stopping at these intersections and making sure that traffic is aware that you're present. That extra minute, that extra 30 seconds that you are going to try to save is not going to be significant for the patient in the back of the ambulance. And I know that's something that's counterintuitive. We're operating in an emergency situation here. But think about how many cases we actually have that are true priority one emergencies that can't be handled by the skills of the provider in the back of that unit. So I want to just remind you drivers out there that you need to be calm, you need to be cool and collected, even if things are going to hell in a handbasket in the back. Doesn't do anybody any good if you guys don't make it safely to the hospital because of a motor vehicle accident. So pay attention to the roads. Don't assume that the drivers around you can see you or hear you, and get your patient and your other providers to the hospital safely. Next up is a story that is looking at a study coming out of Duke University Medical School, and the doctors and people that conducted this study over the last 10 years have looked at 2,800 patients hospitalized for heart disease. They conducted psychological assessments of these patients, asking them to describe their expectations about their ability to recover from their illness and regain a normal life. Following up, after 6 to 10 years, these patients, 978 of them died, 66% dying from heart disease. And what they found was that the patient's expectation for survival had a significant effect on whether they survived or not. Think about it. This article is talking about pessimism and overall outlook having an effect on your survivability from heart disease. So when we need to watch patients and talk to them about their expectations, and if they're gloomy, you know, we've looked at studies in the past on this show and on the blog talking about depression having a significant effect on outlook with people with cardiovascular and heart disease. And this is yet another indication that that general overall attitude, that general mood related to your disease process can have a significant effect on the outcome of that disease process. We in the field can do a lot to help people with that by, first of all, paying attention to their overall mood, relaying some of that information as side information to the physician at the hospital, to the nurse when you hand over care. Let them know, you know, this guy's really been pretty gloomy about his outlook and really is depressed, and I think that might be contributing to his symptoms. Let them, you know, these people read these articles too. These people read these studies as well. They can refer this person to some counseling. They can provide them with maybe some antidepressants. More education from the hospital and from the nurses can go a long way towards educating these patients that they really have a very positive outlook, that their disease is treatable long term, and that they don't have to be pessimistic. And that starts with us. Again, we are the eyes and ears. We see and hear things that the patient might say or do or have going on in their home environment that we can be valuable links to getting that information to the hospital team so that they can provide their resources to this patient. And their resources include counseling. Their resources include better education before they go home. Their resources include interaction with social workers and the ability to provide those patients with additional care after they leave the hospital. So I urge you to check on this and keep this in the back of your mind the next time you're transporting a patient that has a chronic or severe illness, and really monitor their outlook and, you know, provide them a cheerful outlook of your own. Let them know that you think they're going to be okay, if that's indeed what you believe, and that you can provide them some additional support on the way to the hospital. While we're on the topic of medical studies, I will look at an article that I found looking at a study presented to the American Heart Association's 48th Annual Conference on Cardiovascular Disease Epidemiology and Prevention, and it looked at the effects of secondhand smoke on children. They've been looking at some of the cardiovascular disease problems that adults experience and how they are initiated and progress undetected during childhood. And this can be dietary issues, preventable causes of cardiovascular disease that could be addressed younger in age and therefore cause a better profile when people reach adulthood, that these disease processes don't start so early. Secondhand smoke, previously thought really just to be a respiratory problem for children, causing asthma issues and other issues, is now being seen as also causing early cardiovascular damage. And this is related to a study of children, some of them between the ages of 2 and 5 years old, and then adolescents from 9 to 14, looking at the effects of secondhand smoke on these two different age groups. And anybody who studies pediatrics knows that kids change so much over the course of their young lives that children at certain age groups are very different from children at the other end of the scale. Adolescents are more like adults in some ways than toddlers are. Toddlers have different things going on. This study found that children in the younger age group absorbed 5 times the amount of nicotine as the children in the older age group. And this nicotine was causing inflammatory damage to the inner lining of their vessels, the tunica intima, that inner endothelial lining, causing thickening, causing inflammation of those linings, related directly to the amount of secondhand smoke exposure, and that this damage caused early progressed and gave them a higher risk for early heart disease and cardiovascular problems later in life. So this is something just, again, to be aware of and educate about in our communities. If you're a smoker, you need to not be smoking around kids, especially young kids. If you are in a household or you're educating in your community, this is a great thing to do a talk about. You can do a short 20-minute presentation to local community groups about secondhand smoke exposure. Talk about this particular study. Talk about the fact that kids, even with relatively minimal exposure to secondhand smoke, can have a significant effect, even if their parents are not smoking in the house all the time, but smoke in the car. You know, all of these things make a big difference on the later health of children in your community. Preventing illness goes a long way to preventing us from getting overloaded with patients 10, 15, 20 years down the road. We need to be preventing problems now so that our lives are a little easier later on. Finally, I will wrap up with a story here that is really alarming in some respects, having to do with kids as well. Tweens. Tweens are those kids that are not quite teenagers, you know, they're 11, 12, maybe 13 years old. They're not quite into the full-blown adolescence, but they are getting into that age. And what they're finding is that preteens and young teens who use drugs choose to use inhalants as a gateway drug to other drug use later on. They are sniffing household chemicals to get high before moving on to things like marijuana or abusing pain medications. And you think about it, look around your house. You think about what you've got in your garage, under your kitchen sink. Inhalants are everywhere. And many people don't realize that glues, paints, other things, they're just not being bought by these kids for their craft fair or science fair projects. These kids are asking parents to go out and buy these things so that they can use them as an inhalant. So it's important that we are aware of this in our communities. Again, you want to go and do a little talk, one, you know, get together with a friend. One of you talk about secondhand smoke. The other one talk about inhalant use. All of that is really, it's causing severe brain damage. Also, these inhalants also cause damage to other organs. Heart, liver, kidney damage, all can be traced back to inhalant use in kids that are starting this process. Now, this is important to follow up on. 21% of children between the ages of 12 and 17 in this national survey of drug use found that 21% of these kids had used an illicit drug in the past year. Among the youngest people in this survey, 12 or 13-year-olds, inhalants were the most reported class of illicit drug used. And this is something that really is just alarming to me, something that you need to be aware of. And maybe check in with your local poison control center or something like that to find out more about what's common in your area. That leads me into my tip of the week this week rather well, I think. And I'm going to be featuring an interview I set up with Brian Hayes, who is from Maryland Poison Control. He is the pharmacology toxicology fellow there this year. And he shared with me some information about how poison control centers work and also how you should contact your local poison control center, because part of their mandate is to provide information, educational materials, and resources to both the medical and public part of their communities. So you as a medical provider, whether you are an EMT or a paramedic, you can contact your local poison control center and find out if they would be willing to send somebody out to talk to your group or send you some materials that you can use to talk in your community or train your organization. So without further ado, here's Brian Hayes from Maryland Poison Control. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm here today with Brian Hayes from Maryland Poison Control Center. And I'm going to let Brian introduce himself. Brian, welcome to the podcast here.
Thank you very much, Jamie. As you said, I am the clinical toxicology fellow at the Maryland Poison Center, which means I am a pharmacist. I graduated a few years ago, and I am doing a postgraduate two-year fellowship, training fellowship with the Poison Center in toxicology, doing research and teaching and some clinical work. That's basically my position here.
Great, great. Well, I'm looking forward to having this opportunity to learn a little bit about how poison control centers operate, and specifically Maryland Poison Control, but also to learn a little bit more about what some of the issues are that are facing poison control centers in the United States and perhaps even around the world. So let's lead off a little bit with looking at how When someone calls into the Poison Control Center, who are they speaking to when they get someone on the other end of the phone? What is their qualifications?
That's a great question. We get that all the time. So at least at the Maryland Poison Center, all of the people that answer the phones are either nurses or pharmacists with extra or additional training in toxicology. We have 10 full-time poison specialists, as they're called. Six of them are pharmacists and four are nurses. And they staff the phone 24/7, all day, every day for the year. So we have people that are dedicated for the overnight shifts as well. So anytime you call, you'll either get a pharmacist or a nurse that's been trained in toxicology. Some poison centers across the country have they use basically the same approach, but some also have sort of an intermediate training type person called a poison information provider. And those are they are also certified in toxicology as well, but they just are usually more of a part-time basis. But we have all full-time people here in Maryland.
Now, you said certified in toxicology. Is that a national certification standard? Or
it is. All poison centers in the United States, there's 61, and they are all certified. The poison centers themselves are certified through the American Association of Poison Control Centers. And when a poison specialist gets hired and they come on board, within 2 years of them being on board as a poison specialist, they need to take an exam, and that's to show that they are knowledgeable enough in toxicology to operate on the phones, and then they also become certified as a certified poison specialist.
Great. I was not aware of that. So that's a whole nother range of – and this would be something that like an existing RN or somebody would come in as a specialist, either as a pharmacist coming in or as an RN coming in, and then they would be trained and then eventually take this additional certification test.
That is correct.
Okay. Yep. All right. So someone calls in and they call the 800 number. Now I'm assuming that the 800-222-1222 is the national U.S. hotline, and that's standardized across the United States now?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, just a few years ago, all the poison centers had sort of their own numbers to call, just a local number. But a few years back, we got the 800 number certified. So it's sort of like if you call 911. The goal is that wherever you are in the country, you'll get routed to the closest poison center to wherever you are.
Okay.
So if you call that 800 number and you're in Pennsylvania, for example, you'll get routed to the Pittsburgh or the Philadelphia Poison Center, depending on your location. And so if you're in Maryland, you'll get routed to the Maryland Poison Centers. For purposes that are due to location.
Okay. So I call in, I get one of the poison specialists, either a pharmacist or a nurse online. What is the process? Let's just, for instance, say that my child has gotten into the gardening supplies and has gotten into some fertilizer and may or may not have ingested or come in contact with that product. What is the process now? I've called in. I'm a parent. I'm upset. I'm concerned. How does this call progress from this point?
The good news is that, at least for the Maryland Poison Center, we have all the people that operate the phones have been working here for a long time. The least experienced person has been here for over 6 years.
Wow!
We have a very low turnover at our particular poison center, which is fantastic. So the point of that, me saying that, is that when you call and you're an upset parent, one of the first goals is to calm the parent down. Because most of the time when kids get into stuff, they usually don't get into enough to hurt them. Even if it is a toxic substance, a lot of times they don't get into enough to cause toxic effects. So what they're going to do is after they calm down, they're going to get a history from the parent. How old is the child? How much does the child weigh? What is the substance? And usually we like to get real specific as far, not even, you know, just like a fertilizer. If they have the actual brand name of the fertilizer, that really helps us in looking up the product and finding out what the actual ingredients and concentrations are in that particular product. And then we'll ask them for, well, how long ago do you think this was? What's the maximum amount that the child may have gotten into? That's really key with us because we like to really operate cautiously. So if the child ingested a maximum amount of something and that amount is not going to be a problem, then that's obviously a good thing. So we try to be very cautious with our estimates. And then we sort of walk the parents through what typical signs and symptoms might be happening and ask them if any of these things are happening with their child. Is there anything abnormal that they're noticing? Are there burns around their mouth? Are they acting lethargic? Whatever the case may be. And then we make an assessment based on what the product is, what the estimated amount is that the child may have gotten into. And we have, based on lots of literature that's out there on different substances, we have guidelines, and each poison center has guidelines, and there are national guidelines as well for certain substances. And we make a determination on whether or not that child can be monitored at home with just a simple dilution with a drink of water or snack or something, or whether or not they need further attention, and that would be going to the emergency department most of the time. when they do need to be referred. And sometimes we get calls too, and we have a 911 is really calling us, but it's a 911 three-way call with the parents on the phone as well. And then we can make an assessment on whether or not EMS needs to be dispatched to that house or whether or not it's actually not even going to be necessary in that particular case.
Okay, that's something I was not aware of. As a working paramedic here in Maryland, we get poison control on the line via our radio system, and we speak in a three-way conversation with you and our medical control physician. And I was not aware that there was the ability to even make that assessment at the 911 level prior to even my getting the call. And I wouldn't expect to be aware of that because our tones wouldn't have gone off. We wouldn't have been dispatched to that particular location.
Right. And a lot of times we do get called too when it is a 911. When we get kind of called through 911, EMS usually has been dispatched already. So a lot of times what we do is we wait online on the phone with the 911 operator and the parent or whoever is there until EMS gets there, and then we kind of assess it on the scene with EMS. But more commonly, like you said, we get the call through the emergency three-way call with EMS already on the scene, and then we get involved as well as the hospital and kind of what are we going to do during transport kind of stuff there. So
now, is this the when I speak to someone via my radio system via Syscom in Maryland here, am I speaking to the same poison control specialist that is manning the phone lines for the parent as well, or is this a separate? Do you have a separate group of people that are specialized in dealing with medical providers?
Nope. All of our specialists are qualified to do all of the operations. So when you call, we normally, except on the overnight shift when there's only one poison specialist here, during the daytime there's anywhere between two and four at any given time during the day. So those same people will also answer the emergency EMRC EMS phone as well. So it's all the same people.
Now, do you have a specialized resource that your people use? As I'm assuming you must be using a computerized database system of some kind. Are you not Googling, obviously, the product, but do you have access to things like material safety data sheets, or do you have a dedicated poison control database that you access to find information? Because you said you needed specific information on the product and the manufacturer, because you can actually pull up concentrations of different toxic substances.
We can, and there is a specific one for that we use most of the time. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but there's a database out there called Micromedics.
Okay.
And there's a subset of that Micromedics called PoisonDex. And that is one of the main databases that we use at the Poison Center. It's funny that you mention it, though, because there's sometimes those databases can only be updated at whatever intervals they're updated at, you know, every month or and so on. So sometimes, for example, I'll give you an example. A lot of the Sudafed products, the products over the counter that used to contain pseudoephedrine, now that they're limited by federal law and usually behind the counter at the pharmacy, a lot of those companies change their product to contain another ingredient called phenylephrine.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lag time between when that actually happens and when that information gets entered into the PoisonDex database. So every once in a while, it may not be completely up to date as far as that goes. So it was kind of funny that you mentioned sort of Google, but it's actually not that funny because we do use Google sometimes. When we get a product name, I mean, that's why we really want to know exactly what it is, because, you know, there's 100 different NyQuil products out there, and what
right.
kind of drugs do they contain? What are the concentrations in those? And sometimes the PoisonDex database that we use may not have every one of those. So we can go to Google or NyQuil or wherever we can go to an actual website and find out what the ingredients are. And then once we know what the ingredients are, then we have training in once we know exactly what the ingredients are. But we do use Google sometimes.
Well, no, that's
Google's a great resource.
It's a great tool when you can't find something you need to find in a hurry. It can be an excellent tool to use. I agree with you 100%. Now, this, you brought up an interesting point. I know when I go into people's homes and are looking at their medications and their med lists, or sometimes if they're unresponsive, I'm looking in their medicine cabinet. Mm-hmm. Do you run into issues where people are using, you know, NyQuil from 10 years ago that has a different formulation? Or is that something that you ask about? How current is the medication? Or is that something that you've seen that has come up?
We... I can't say that we've seen it come up too often. We do have a lot of times where there's empty pill bottles around, prescription pill bottles, mm-hmm. usually, or not necessarily. It could be Tylenol or over-the-counter products as well. And sometimes we'll ask about expiration dates and stuff. But a lot of times the expiration dates that are on there are really, it doesn't necessarily mean that the drug's going to not work anymore. It just means that it may have a little bit less of an effect than it would have had prior to the expiration date. But that's a good point that you bring up with, for example, we'll go back to the NyQuil products that may have contained Sudafed before, and now they contain the phenylephrine. So what we do is we literally ask whoever it is, whether it be the EMS provider or the parent or the caregiver, to read us the ingredients off the side of the bottle. And that's really what helps us the most, rather than just even a product name sometimes is what is it? How much acetaminophen is in a teaspoon? How much Sudafed? How much Benadryl? That kind of stuff. And that usually helps us. That way it doesn't really matter how old the product is. As long as there's a label on there, we can kind of figure out exactly what's in it.
Well, that's great. I mean, it just occurred to me when we were talking about that, because you were talking about the changes in the Sudafed, and I wondered about old medications. So that's mm-hmm. a great way to handle that and look at that. When different medical personnel come in contact with people that might have suspected poisonings, and I'm talking about paramedics, EMTs, or even nurses that are doing home care visits, what information is it vitally important that they have available for you if they're the one calling in?
If it's a healthcare provider that's calling in, that's actually a little bit more helpful, because a lot of the more serious drugs, overdoses will cause like hypotension and bradycardia and things like that. And that's not really easily assessed by a layperson like a parent or a caregiver that's not really trained in medical procedures. So things like that would really help. Can we get a pulse rate? Do we have respirations? Do we have just basically the vital signs? Those are really important. And then also, what kind of drugs are around? Like what are the drugs that they have available to them, and what doses? And even things such as when were they? And a lot of times the pharmacies are getting pretty good now about having lots of information on the label, so you can even look usually on the label and find out how long ago was this filled from the pharmacy? Because a lot of times we'll get a call that this was filled yesterday, and they're all gone. Or we could have, it was filled 3 months ago, and so we're not quite sure how many were actually missing because they should all be gone. So that kind of information helps too, because we can sort of get an assessment of how much was actually involved in this ingestion.
So they really need to have a handle on the big picture and get a good history. And then be able to relay that information along with current vital signs and patient presentation to you.
And it's good too, because we seem to have a pretty good relationship with the EMS people that call in too. And so they obviously give us all of the information that they normally give. And then the poison specialists are pretty good at asking, depending on whatever drugs are on the scene, they're really good at asking the right questions in a quick time frame to make a pretty good assessment if that information wasn't provided already. So.
Now, that's fantastic, and it's something that we need to be aware of. I think many of us aren't aware of poison control centers and how much information. I also know that you like to provide a lot of information just for public education purposes. Mm-hmm. Is that something that's most poison centers provide nationwide, and is that something that any healthcare person or any person in the public can contact and get publications or information?
Yeah. The answer to your second question is yes. Anyone can call in and get any information from us. We're very fortunate in that in order to be certified, like I said, under the American Association of Poison Control Centers, there needs to be a certain amount of education that needs to be done from each poison center each year. We're very lucky in Maryland in that we actually have two coordinators. We have a specific person that's the professional education coordinator, and she is in charge of giving education to EMS people, to nurses, to hospitals, all the professional education type things. And then we have a separate person that's dedicated to public education issues. So she does a lot with schools, a lot with safe kids organizations and parent organizations, and basically poison center outreach and education and just kind of making people aware that the Poison Center is here, all that kind of stuff. So we're lucky in that we have two separate people that kind of each have their own track that they're dedicated to. And each of those positions, that they give literature on obviously the different scope. But like our professional education coordinator sends out monthly Tox Tidbits, which is just a one-page article on what usually we like to do it on a topic that's been coming up a lot in the recent month. So for example, when the new cyanide antidote became available, we did a talk, and it's just a one-page write-up so that it's easy for ED or emergency department or EMS people to read very quickly and just get a basic understanding of what's going on. So we like to do that kind of stuff every month in addition to all the other stuff, education kind of stuff that we like to do.
Yeah, and I print that stuff out and post it in my fire department and it's great. It is literally a one page quick look that you can put on a bulletin board in your facility. And it's just a quick read for people as they're going by. And it just provides a great overview of information. I subscribe to your newsletters on email and have been for some time and really enjoy getting them. So, now you guys are located at mdpoison.com, Maryland Poison, mdpoison.com. And there actually is a link to sign up for those email newsletters right there on the main page.
There is, and I'm glad you brought that up, because what I was going to say is, if you don't like getting your email inbox cluttered with everybody's email inbox is always full of stuff. So if you're one of those people that just likes to go to the website, they're all up there and you can read all of them online without getting a monthly email too, if you prefer it to be that way. But
right,
like you said, mdpoison.com, and you can get all that information.
Fantastic. Well, I'm going to, as we wrap up the interview here a little bit, I want to just kind of move into looking at the upcoming, or actually when this interview airs, it'll be National Poison Control Week, or poison prevention. What is the big issue this year for poison control centers? What has been the targeted topic for you to be focusing on as community outreach and poison prevention?
Well, our goal always, it doesn't really change from year to year, and our goal is really to educate the public on what the Poison Center does and why it's important for people to call. And I think another one of the questions that we wanted to cover was kind of what issues are facing poison centers these days.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's going to sound monotonous because it seems to be the same issue that's facing everyone, but it's really funding issues.
Mm.
Depending on which poison center you are at, a lot of the funding comes from either the hospital that you're situated in. Here in Maryland, we're part of the pharmacy school. So we get a lot of our funding through the state, but funding is really an issue as far as just funding the staff and the outreach and the education and things like that. So that's obviously always an ongoing issue. But the more that we can provide education and outreach and have people calling into the Poison Center for whatever reason, then we can increase the number of calls that we get and basically show that. It's been shown many times that poison centers reduce the amount of emergency department visits each year because of the way that we're able, I think up like 70% of the calls that we get, we're able to manage at home rather than those patients going to the ED and spending healthcare dollars. So it's actually a really good thing to call. And that way we can hopefully keep most of the people at home, and save the healthcare dollars and the stress on the emergency departments and the EMS people.
So it's important to stress to everyone that's listening to spread the word that their local poison control center is a resource for them, not just for that single isolated poisoning emergency that they may want to cross once in a lifetime, but also as a resource for ongoing prevention efforts. And certainly they should contact and utilize them and make sure that they let their lawmakers know and be aware that this is an important resource to have available.
Exactly.
Great.
We're also available too. We do a lot of, I just wanted to mention one more thing.
Oh, that's absolutely, take your time.
In addition to all of the calls that we handle as far as exposures or people getting into things, the Poison Center also gets lots of calls about just typical drug information type calls, drug interactions and typical drug information calls. So if any of the nurses or EMS healthcare providers out there need to know something about a drug, then they can certainly feel free to call the Poison Center for something like that as well. Even if it's not an emergency call, we can certainly provide that information. We also, a lot of times it's very helpful, is EMS will arrive on the scene somewhere and there's empty bottles and no labels and all they have are the tablets, and we can actually help identify those tablets as well for them based on the imprint codes on them. So that way we can help determine what the possible overdose was, and that's obviously really helpful in situations like that as well.
And you also deal with all kinds of environmental poisonings, all kinds of situations, not just drug overdoses, mm-hmm. not just in, accidental ingestions, but things like spider bites, plant contacts, things like that as well.
Yes. Fortunately, in Maryland, we don't have a big problem with the poisonous spiders and snakes, but we do deal with those kind of calls as well, poisoning by spiders or snakes. We don't have a lot of marine poisonings, like poisonous fish around the Maryland area, fortunately, as well. But anywhere from drugs, but it's also about plants and, you know, the chemicals that you have around your house, or spiders or snakes, or, you know, we really run the gamut as far as what types of things, mercury thermometers that are really not very mainstream anymore. There's not a whole lot of them out there, but there are other products that do contain very small amounts of mercury, like the fluorescent light bulbs and things like that be broken. And Baltimore really still has a big problem with lead. So we certainly deal with some lead poisoning issues as well. So it's really, it keeps the job interesting because you never know what kind of call you're, it's just like when you guys respond to a scene, you never know what you're going to get. And it's always, even if it's the same drug, it's always a different scenario. So it keeps it very exciting and interesting.
Well, that's fantastic. And it's important to understand, I think, that you're a resource just of a broad scope of opportunities for anybody in the healthcare field to get additional information about all kinds of things. Like you said, lead poisoning, contact with other substances, plants, animals, all information can be found with your local Poison Center and specifically at the Maryland Poison Center. Brian, I want to thank you very much for sharing your time here with the community here at the MedicCast Network, both the Nursing Show and the MedicCast podcast. Is there any final point you'd like to leave with the medical people that are listening to the shows?
I guess the only thing is just to kind of reiterate that we are here as a consultant resource, and we love to get calls, especially from EMS and healthcare providers, and we look forward to working with them in the future and to providing as much information as they need, and we're really here to help. So to really just feel free to call whenever you have a problem that you think we can help with.
And that number is nationwide. Go ahead.
1-800-222-1222. That's the national toll-free hotline for poison centers.
Fantastic. I want to thank Brian again for sharing that information with us. And it is Poison Prevention Week here in the United States and maybe worldwide. I know it's National Poison Prevention Week here, March 16th through, I believe, the 23rd. So you have an opportunity to get out there and do a little education yourself. Poison Prevention Week is a great time to think about preventing both accidental and intentional poisonings. And contact your local poison control center and find out how they can help you be better educated and work better in the field. You can also head over to the show notes for this episode. There's a link to Maryland Poison Control and also a link to sign up directly for their Tox Tidbits email newsletter. A great way to get information sent to you directly by email. And they provide me with a lot of information I share with you here on the show, but it's a great way for you to get that information as well. And it's free. Even if you don't live in the state of Maryland, they'd be happy to send that information out to you. They send you a link, you click on that and go back to their website and download it. That lets you know when it's available. So thanks again, Brian, and thanks to Maryland Poison Control for setting up this interview. That's going to wrap up this episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show. And remember, you got links to everything I've talked about here over at MedicCast.com/blog in the show notes pages there. I also want to remind you all that you can get in touch with me here by email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also leave me a voicemail message over at the voicemail line, and that's 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-3342. medic. And when you leave that message there, if you want to, leave your email address at the very end. I'll clip it off, but it gives me a way to get back in touch with you if I need to leave you a message there and get some more information about your question or comment. If you'd like to share even more with the MedicCast listeners and community, head on over to the MedicCast forums at forums.mediccast.com, or you can even sign up for the newsletter, and there's a link in the show notes for the newsletter and also available over at the MedicCast site. At the MedicCast blog, sign up for the newsletter, and you can get the show notes and all the links sent directly to you every month. I'll wrap up, as I always do, with some great PodSafe music. This is from an artist I haven't played in a long time, Cody Prevost. He's a country western style artist and plays some great songs. I urge you to head over and check out his site at codyprevost.com. There's also a link in the show notes. If you'd like to go to iTunes and purchase his songs, you can do so directly there. And Cody will be performing tonight a song called Spin. This is one of his new offerings. I got this via email from Cody, so check it out and enjoy it. And you can find out more via his website, linked to in the show notes. Let him know you heard it here on the MedicCast. So without further ado, and hoping you all are safe and secure this coming week, I will sign off and say, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Until next time, scene safety, BSI.
There's a four-way stop in an old cafe where everyone in town would start their day. Grab a nice cold drink at the pump and pay. Our weekend spent down at the lake. But something started telling me it's time to disappear. So one day I made the tires on my old Cavalier. Spinning down the highway, pedal down Chevrolet. Nothing standing in my way. Hey, hey, like a dust devil in the field. Like a kid's pinwheel whirling in the wind. My wheels were just made to spin. Mama's home cooking and to see old friends. Grab a cup of coffee and catch up on the news. I can see nothing's changed in a minute or two. I start getting restless when I'm standing still. When the light turns green, I make those wheels. Yeah!